In this part of Focus, we will try to spend some time talking about what archaeology might be able to tell us about climate change. Perhaps not so much about why climate changes, but about how human beings try to cope with those changes. Between the 10th and the 15th centuries, the Earth experienced a rise in average temperature, and that had global effects. In Western Europe, these effects generally were positive. The temperature went up. The summers were longer. The winters were milder. This was good for agriculture. Population grew. Culture flourished. This is a period that is known as the medieval warm period, roughly between the years 800 and 1300. However, other places around the globe did not fare so well. There were some societies that actually collapsed because of severe and prolonged drought. And in fact, our guest for this morning's show, Brian Fagan, argues that drought may well be the hidden and most dangerous element in global warming today. And indeed, our guest for the program is Brian Fagan. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's done field work in Africa. He's written about early man, forensic archaeology, and a lot of other topics. And the one book that he has authored, it's been out now for about a year, that has gotten a lot of attention, deals with this subject of past climate change. The title of the book is The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Was first published, as I said, about a year ago, and now is out in paperback, published by Bloomsbury, if you'd like to read it. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a conference on climate change that's going on this week through the rest of the week. And in fact, he'll be giving the keynote speech at the conference. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. So that's going on here on the campus. The book is out if you want to seek it out in the bookstore or the library. And here as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief just so we can accommodate as many as possible and keep things moving along. Well, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
There are many people from different disciplines who are looking at climate change. Climatologists, of course, geologists, biologists. You're an anthropologist. What is your interest in climate change?
My interest in climate change is about the relationship between humans and climate change. Until relatively recently, climatology lived in one universe, and anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians lived in another. And the two never talked. And this, of course, is a classic feature of academic life. You have these disciplinary boundaries. But in the last 10 years, increasingly, the boundaries are falling and people are really beginning to talk to each other. And it's emerging that one of the most fascinating things about climate change in the past is the impact it's had on human societies, large and small, simple and very complex. And archaeology is unique because it is the only scientific discipline which enables you to look at changes in human society over long periods of time, not just decades and centuries, but thousands of years. And this puts us in a rather unique position to look at the impact of climate on humans.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about what is in the Great Warming and start by asking you just to talk a little bit about this, the period that I mentioned, the medieval warm period, what we know about it, and how it is we know those things about it.
The medieval warm period is a rather ill-defined period of history. It is a period when global temperatures rose slightly for about four or five centuries. There was, for example, a prevalence of long, relatively dry summers in Europe. And this period was first identified by a British meteorological historian called Hubert Lamb back in the 60s. And really, at that time, a great deal was not known about it, largely because we lacked the increasingly precise indicators of climate change that we now have. Stalagmites in caves, tree rings, and so on. And in recent years, these proxies, as they're called, indirect indicators of climate change, have increasingly shown us that we really can look at the medieval warm period in much more detail than we could before. And obviously, when you're dealing with a period 1,000 years ago, you're looking at events which chronologically you're looking 50 years, 20 years, 100 years, depending where you are. And I got very interested in the medieval one because earlier I wrote a book about the Little Ice Age, which is the cold period, which was at its maximum about the 17th and 18th centuries. And I wondered about this and started to think about medieval peasants in Europe and so on. But when I really got into the subject, I discovered that it was global and that the impact of warmer temperatures in other parts of the world, especially arid and semi-arid environments, was completely different.
Yeah.
And you're talking about drought, lack of rainfall, and a great deal of human suffering.
In Europe at this time, and one of the things that you write about in the book, you want to make sure people understand that even when conditions were good, life was difficult, and that we're talking about a time here, a fairly long period of time, where things were up and down. It doesn't mean that everything was wonderful the whole time through, but there was this enhancing effect on agriculture. It was warmer. Growing seasons were longer. It was warmer further north. That changed, in some respects, it changed what people grew and where they grew it. All of that was indeed good for population.
Yes, it was. The medieval warm period was generally good for Europe. But the thing people forget about medieval Europe, and it's easy for us to forget this because we go and buy our food from supermarkets, is that nearly everybody lived from one harvest to the next. And famine, hunger, famine-related diseases were realities and malnutrition in everybody's lives, certainly peasants. And therefore, to have a period of warmer, drier summers where the temperatures were warm and favorable for growing at the end of the growing season was a huge bounty, and it made quite a lot of difference. And in that sense, the medieval warm period as a whole was very good for Europe. What you must never think of the medieval warm period of, or any climate change, is as a warmer period. It was a period where the climate was just as variable from year to year as it is now. It was just generally a little warmer and a little more settled.
And we can, now we have the perspective of being able to look back and having this long record, and we can see how things play out over a long period of time. I don't suppose that people at the time took particular notice. It was not dramatic enough so that we have written accounts of people saying something unusual is going on here because it's unusually warm and the growing seasons are longer than they used to be.
No, it's fascinating because instrument records of weather go back in Europe and parts of North America only about 200 years, and really they're not that accurate until the 20th century. So really before that you're relying on climatic proxies, and one of the climatic proxies are observations by people of exceptional climatic conditions. We're all familiar with this. Let's say you have an ice storm here, and someone will say, this is the worst ice storm I remember in 50 years of living here. Mm-hmm. Or we had some years ago a very dry year in California. This is the driest year on record. We're merely comparing it to our life experience. If you look at climate over long periods of time, it's nothing unusual because climate is a constant seesaw. Never stops and never will stop. And people who think about there being a warming era in the future and it's going to be beautiful and uniform warmth are talking nonsense. The world's climate, even if humans interfere, has never been like that.
And I know that your interest in writing this book was not necessarily to weigh in on the climate change debate, the role of human activity. And certainly I think people have probably used, people who were partisans in this debate have used your book one way or another, either to argue about response to climate change or to make the other argument that says, well, what we know now about the way that humans have contributed to the warming has to do with contemporary levels of population and technology and burning fossil fuels. And they would say, well, people in the Middle Ages, they weren't doing all this. So it couldn't have had anything to do with them, and I suppose people take that and use that to try to make the argument that, in fact, what we're seeing now is somehow the result of natural cycles. They happen, it gets colder, gets warmer, that it's not really about human activity.
It's fascinating. My email is a remarkable phenomenon. How dare you suggest that humans are responsible for global warming? Or, of course they're not. Or, why do you not make a stronger case from this? Let me send you a copy of my paper. And you look at the paper and it was sponsored by whatever. And there were so many interest groups out there all pushing their agendas. I'm very distressed is the wrong word, really, but concerned how politicized climate change has become as an issue. I'm also very, very tired of self-styled prophets and visionaries, some of whom believe they are kind of almost divine prophets. I mean, it's frightening. This sort of almost becomes a faith that you believe in this. But if you take all that away, what we're dealing with, for me, is a very simple issue. What was the effect of climate change in the past on all sorts of different human societies, not just in Europe or in Connecticut, but around the world? And are there perhaps some lessons we can draw from this from the future at a very general level? You cannot use the past to prophesy the future, but you can use it to say, well, that's interesting. Maybe there's an implication here.
Yeah.
And I don't go further than that.
You do. Your interest, though, is in part in looking at how it is that people in the past responded to the changes that, were going on at the time, and then asking this question, well, by looking at what people did or maybe didn't do, are there some lessons for us now
to be drawn from that? That is very much so. And really, the most interesting context, I'm finding a lot of it is water. Because if you look at how people manage water, the effects of even a slight climate change, say on the Arizona desert, on irrigation agriculture there, this is of very fundamental importance in the past and also today. Because generally the more sedentary and complex a society is, the more vulnerable it is to extreme climatic events. I mean, imagine a Category 5 hurricane coming down in the middle of Miami Beach. Or imagine, as may well happen, a 50-year drought in the Sierra in California.
We have as our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Brian Fagan. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he has written a good deal on the interaction of climate and human society, including his most recent book, the book that came out just about a year ago. The title is The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's now out in paperback, published by Bloomsbury Press. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in the conference Planet U, The Human Story of Climate Change. A lot of different folks coming from all over, people here at this campus and from elsewhere coming here to talk about climate change. It's going on for beginning today and for the rest of the week. And indeed, our guest will be giving the keynote speech for the conference. That's tonight at 7 o'clock in the Illini Union. We're here and open to whatever questions you might have. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here, so let's bring them into the conversation. Someone in Champaign, and this would be line one. Hello.
Good morning, David. Good morning, Dr. Fagan.
Good morning.
I'm planning on attending the Planet U conference the next few days. I'm really very much looking forward to it, especially your keynote this evening. I had one quick factual question and then one a little bit more of an open-ended question. What was the total magnitude of the medieval warm period? How much of a rise in temperature did you see from the baseline?
The answer to that is we don't exactly know. I would be play it safe and say several degrees centigrade warmer in the summers. The information we have on the medieval period, warm period, is still rather vague beyond a general trend to it having been generally warmer, although variable. There are some people, indeed, who suggest the medieval warm period doesn't exist. But if you said several degrees centigrade, you'd probably be okay.
All right. You said several degrees centigrade warmer in the summer. How does that compare to perhaps like predictions of the IPCC in terms of climate change in the 21st century, because they usually talk about like a total increase in global temperature averaged over the whole year.
This, of course, comes into the famous discussion over the so-called hockey stick. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is really a very tired debate. I don't think we really know. I suspect that the future is going to be warmer than the medieval warm.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, the temperature will generally be warmer than the medieval warm period, but how much warmer we have no means of knowing. I think that the IPCC projections are probably as good as we can get.
I see. Okay, so significant, but the magnitude and comparing it to the present day is still a very broad,
I think comparing the medieval warm's temperatures with today's temperatures is just really a rather empty academic exercise. I don't think it really means much.
Okay.
Largely because we can't be particularly precise about temperatures 1,000 years ago.
All right. I want to move on to a more open-ended question, which was to talk about your colleague in anthropology, Jared Diamond. I read all of his books, and the one most pertinent to this is Collapse. I was thinking particularly of his discussion of the Chaco Canyon people, which is a civilization in what we now know as the Southwest that collapsed, if I'm remembering correctly, right around this time period. I might be wrong about that. And one among the many problems that led to the destruction of that civilization was the overshoot in terms of use of the local native resources and also in terms of just the overall population relative to the carrying capacity of the environment. And so I was wondering if you see any of that perhaps at the margins of Europe where you had societies that perhaps oversubscribed given the relative bounty of the medieval warm period and then were forced to retreat and pull back in the face of the later ice age when the ecosystem was not as hospitable to the complexity and level of population that had developed. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Chaco Canyon is, I haven't read Jared Diamond's book called Collapse, so I have no idea what he said. But Chaco Canyon is a very complex, oddly enough, I actually did do a lengthy study of it and wrote a book about it. Chaco Canyon didn't collapse, it was abandoned, and there was a big difference. What, in fact, one of the primary triggers for its abandonment was exactly as you pointed out. It was prolonged 50-year droughts, which are chronicled in tree rings, and then the people who have a long tradition of movement in the face of drought simply moved away. Chaco really could never support more than about 2,200 people off its own agriculture. It probably was a major ceremonial center which saw large numbers of people coming in for major seasonal ceremonies. And in Europe, where the situation in the medieval warm was somewhat different, yet some ways similar, you got population growth and a tremendous increase in the rate of forest clearance and the taking up of marginal lands, many of them on slopes and higher ground. And then at the beginning of the Little Ice Age, you had a period of about 7 years when there were a series of extremely wet summers. And the effect was effectively to wash crops out of the ground. And there was soil erosion, and a large number of people living on marginal lands were literally washed off the ground. And between, I think it was 1215 and 1221, something like 1.5 million European farmers died of famine and famine-related diseases. And also there were cattle diseases and sheep diseases as well. It was a catastrophic period, and much of the catastrophe was due to people living on marginal lands who couldn't cope with the climatic downturn.
Hmm. All right. Well, I would thank the listener for the call. We have somebody else here. This is someone in Urbana, and we'll talk next with them. Line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. The period you talk about that your book is about is probably the world population had to be what? Under a billion?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So their actual physical effect on the planet was marginal to the at best, because the technology was way just wasn't there. I mean, you might be able to cut four small groups of forests down. And when you speak of Chaco Canyon, you know, you're right about abandonment. It wasn't really, because I went out there one many years ago, and it's actually really an interesting little drive if anybody wants to go out there. But I was thinking more of how we, in our modern sense, our technology allows us to strip, you know, the environment of almost everything. And it's almost like suicidal destructive behavior. And the amount of people involved now is so much more, and the technology changes it to be more of a man-made problem than the problem you speak of in the past, which was more natural phenomenon. And you're correct about climate changes every 10 or 20,000 years in a natural phenomenon. But whether we're accelerating it or modifying it or making it better or worse is a debatable subject. Could you respond to that?
It's very interesting. I'm 72, mm-hmm. and I can remember when I was young how many fewer people there were around.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure maybe you, I don't know how old you are, but you
maybe 60.
Yeah, well, the same thing. You realize how much more crowded the world is.
Yeah.
And there is no question at all that the advent of the Industrial Revolution was a turning point in our relationship with all kinds of natural environments. And I don't think we've really fully appreciated, or maybe we are now, the full impact that humanity has had on the environment. It is, quite simply, catastrophic. And the world I deal with, and there was something nice about living in the past, I can tell you, the world, the impact of humans was globally far less, but locally could be extremely severe. And indeed, Chaco Canyon's one example. Another example would be parts of Europe with the clearing of the primordial forest, which for thousands of years had been a vital source of firewood, browse for pigs, source of wild edible plants to be eaten in hungry years, and also used as medicines for hunting and so on. And the impact was terrible. If you go to Africa, the increase of population after medieval period had a huge impact on African agriculture, on things like local irrigation, on slash-and-burn agriculture. But the real intensification has come since the Industrial Revolution. The impact of this on long-term global climate is something that is still being debated.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, do you think that because we think locally, because most people, even though they may travel, they still live within a small space, like, let's say, 50-mile radius, but they still, like you were saying earlier about there's the worst ice storm in 20 years or whatever, people still think locally, but their actions are global, where the fact they pump CO2 through cars and, you know, furnaces and stuff, and then that causes acidification. They get fish from the ocean. I mean, it's brought to them. I mean, we get exotic fish in this area from, you know, 5,000 miles away. So our actions are, we still think locally, psychologically, but actually our actions are truly global in nature. Would you say that's a good analysis?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair analysis. But then, of course, you have to realize something else, mm-hmm. that since War II, or War I, certainly, our perspectives may have been 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 19th century, I suspect a lot of people's was 20 miles.
Oh, yeah.
I was brought up in a village in England, mm-hmm. 150 miles from London, and there were people there who hadn't been more than 5 miles from their village.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah, and I know of your book, and I know what you write. Thank you very much.
Right,
my pleasure. Well, just to take this point a little further, I know that there are people who have made this argument that somehow the pre-industrial people of the ancient world were somehow more in touch with their environment and were better managers of it. And I think, though, that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that even pre-industrial people at their levels of population could be very good at exhausting the resources of their neighborhood in terms of doing things like cutting down all the trees or hunting all the animals. So I think that it's probably true that, you know, by today's standards, a relatively small amount of people can still do a lot of damage to their environment.
Oh, yes. Look at the Romans in the Mediterranean. They fished out a lot of the Mediterranean, for example. Then they started fish farming. You've got Native Americans. Everyone says, oh, the Native Americans lived in harmony with the environment. Did they hell? No. And I'm not being anti-Native American. It's the truth. Firewood, good example. The stripping of much of Britain's, of its oak trees for masts, for ships. Kauri wood in New Zealand. I mean, ships used to sail to New Zealand to get kauri for masts. It was such good wood. This goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I suppose that was part of the interest of people in Britain in the New World. One of the things they knew they could get there was that they knew there were big trees there.
One of the most fascinating ones, and this is still not very well known, and the only reason I know about it is I, by chance, read the research of an independent Norwegian scholar, that the Norse in Greenland, between about 990 and 1450, lived in a treeless environment, and they depended on their ships. Mm-hmm. And the closest timber to them was in Labrador. And this guy theorizes they would take their ships, sail over to Labrador, pull them apart, recycle the nails, smelt new iron fittings, cut down trees, build new ships on the beach, and sail home, taking with them the iron from the old ships, which they would trade to the Inuit in Baffinland. Mm. What would they trade for? Walrus ivory. Why walrus ivory? Because it was a tithe to the church back in Norway. Mm. You get these extraordinary connections that people think up. I think it's a very interesting idea.
We have a couple of callers here. We're just to add our midpoint here. And again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Brian Fagan. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's author of the book, The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilization. It's been out now for about a year. It's out now in paperback, published by Bloomsbury Press. He's here on the campus for Planet U, The Human Story of Climate Change. It's a three-day conference looking at climate change. Many sponsors on the campus. I won't go down the entire list. But if you're interested in finding out more, there is a website, and that is www.planetu, so that's PLANETU, planetu.illinois.edu. Brian Fagan is going to give the keynote speech for the conference. That's tonight at 7 at the Illini Union. We have some other folks who would like to join in on our conversation. So next we'll go to the community of Belgium, not too far away, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. The aspect I'd like to direct your conversation towards is the whole basis of what you're talking about is really water. I mean, the prime mover in this whole planet is water. And fresh water is the most important of all. And if I remember right, the Mayan civilization really treasured its water, and they had deep wells that the kings would control and divvy out to whoever they wanted to. And we've had this process many places all over the earth. It seems, though, with these newer, warmer times that might be heading towards drought, well, we in the Midwest happen to have a very good source of fresh water, the Great Lakes, and also the ice caps on both ends are very good sources of fresh water. Fresh water seems to be, it's going to be a real tool in the forming of the future.
I'm glad you brought that up. I am, oddly enough, in the early stages of writing a history of humans' relationships with water, which is an absolutely fascinating and very complex subject. And you are absolutely correct. The most fundamental thing in human existence, ultimately, is water. And you know the funny thing about it? We don't think about it. We just turn on a faucet, or we turn on the sprinklers to our yard, or we wash our cars, we take a shower. We don't think about water. We take it for granted. But an awful lot of human societies in the past, and indeed today, never take water for granted. They can't afford to. For example, the Australian Aborigines live a very powerful symbolic existence, which they call the dream time, which is passed verbally from one generation to the next. There are groups in the Australian desert whose dream time chants and mnemonic recitations revolve around finding your way from one water source to another across the desert within your territory. And this information is passed from one generation to the next. It's such a fundamental part of their existence. And as you rightly point out, with the Maya, and this isn't generally known, their pyramids, in fact, were water catchments as well. And who controlled water had power. And a great deal of the ritual in Maya society revolved also around water and the power of Maya lords to control water. And one of the speakers at the conference is actually going to talk about this, and I think it'll be very interesting.
I see. It seems though we're rapidly going towards directions that we may not have very good relationships with our northern neighbors because we share a lot of water with them. Seems that's going to be an ongoing thing, rivers flowing from one place to another. It's going to be a very, very difficult time to work this all out.
Oh, yes, and futurists say that some of the wars of the future are going to be about water.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. You've touched on the precarious nature of medieval civilization, and it seems to me it would be pertinent to look at the period roughly 400 or 500 years prior to the one you're looking at, the 5th and 6th centuries, where archaeologists excavating cemeteries have found evidence of skeletal deformities and indications that many of the people were probably mentally retarded, probably from dietary deficiency, and that it was only the introduction of the chickpea at a little bit later period that relieved this condition. This seems to me pertinent to the condition of civilization in the northern part of Europe. If you'd care to examine that, thank you.
I really don't know much about the period you're talking about. I am but an amateur when it comes to the medieval period. There is enormous volumes of data on the existence of malnutrition and episodes of dietary stress in ancient populations. For example, and I'm not evading your question, I'm getting it in a rather roundabout way. If you look at the famous Iceman in the Alps, who perished high in the Alps, I think in about 2300 BC, his anatomy and medical history is better known to us than it was to him. There were episodes of malnutrition in him on several occasions when he was a teenager. And if you look at any medieval cemetery, you will find abundant evidence of parasites and malnutrition. And the period you're talking about, I think, was a period of considerable climatic stress, if I recall. And as you rightly point out, the introduction of other crops like chickpeas did have quite an effect. But in the long run, lack of sanitation, living from one harvest to the next, made episodes of malnutrition and dietary stress almost inevitable. And also, of course, you get chronic skeletal conditions due to, for example, women spending a lot of time on their knees grinding grain. And that produces chronic back stress, and also, oddly enough, of all things, stress in the toes, because you bend your toes over when you kneel, and things like that. So this whole study of ancient anatomy relative to diet and so on is very much in its early stages. I'm sorry I don't know much about the period you're talking about, but I'm sure what you're saying is true.
To another caller, Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Well, I hope I'm not being repetitive, but I'm thinking of I think it was the 18th or 19th century that Krakatoa created a lot of problems worldwide. And that event and others in the past and perhaps in the future, and how it could, and then that meteor that I've read about that hit somewhere in Greenland and all the dinosaurs disappeared due to the dust and what, you know, the eruption that that created. And have you studied that element of the effects of that on the world? And then I think in St. Louis in the Mississippi Valley, there was a group of people who either ate everything or were consumed by the burning of wood and their respiratory problems.
The That is a very diffuse question. I will give you a series of answers. Yes, events like Krakatoa or Mount Tambora, which blew up in Southwest Asia, Southeast Asia in 1815, which produced so much ash into the atmosphere that we had a year without a summer. And that was the summer when the poet Shelley and his wife Mary went on vacation with Lord Byron to the Swiss lakes, and it was so cold they stayed indoors and told stories, and Shelley invented Frankenstein. That's the most famous one. There is, of course, the Santorini earthquake eruption of 88 BC, which caused enormous disruptions in the Mediterranean. And then there was the mother of all eruptions, which was Mount Toba, which there were experts on this campus, which erupted about 73,000 years ago and is estimated to have covered most of India with ash and decimated enormous numbers of the world's population, which of course then was teeny. So eruptions have had an enormous effect, but we're still very much in the infancy of the study of their effects. There is a man at Harvard, for example, who's studying the effects of volcanoes on medieval agriculture with interesting results, but they're not published yet. The meteor impacts, I know nothing about. I'll pass over that one, except to say that obviously if we have a meteor impact, we're going to have trouble. The one about wood is very interesting because you get a very frequent condition. When you do get ancient remains preserved, you often, and this is true of the Inuit in particular, you get lung conditions, black lung, which are caused by inhaling soot and smoke in close quarters when you live in huts, crowded huts in the winter for months on end. I'm not familiar with the example from St. Louis you're talking about, but this, of course, is entirely possible. I just know nothing about it.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Brian Fagan. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's written a good deal on the interaction of climate and human society, and his most recent book, if you're interested in reading more on the subject, is The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's now out in a paperback edition published by the Bloomsbury Press. He's here visiting the campus for a conference on climate change. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers we'd like to call. And indeed, we have another caller here ready to go in Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Apropos the drought effects, just on campus last night, there was a screening of a film from Canada called Deep Blue, which is about water issues on a global scale and the effect of climate change, climate disruption. I think you were on about a year ago, and I was asking you about speaking of Canada, this great ice dam breaking.
Yes, yeah.
And mm-hmm. how it's changed the pattern of flow in the Gulf Stream in the North Atlantic and caused the mini ice age. And I bring it up, and not because it's germane to your studies, but it just seems to highlight the fact that, I mean, we're having a cold winter here in the cold spring in the Midwest, and people are going, oh, well, doesn't look like global warming to me, duh. So, I mean, I'm just the unintended consequences, that's why some people are not talking about global warming. They're talking about climate disruption or to that effect. And you can have a regional R on a planetary basis, I guess, is another illustration of that. I don't know if you want to react to that.
We kind of got into this a little earlier, and I remember your previous question now about the Lake Agassiz breaking into the North Atlantic. One of the things they're talking about now is perhaps that the Greenland ice sheet will implode, and we'll get the same effect with the release of huge quantities of fresh water into the Atlantic, partially shutting down the Gulf Stream, and then Europe and much of North America will be plunged into another cold period. The fact of the matter is that there is no way we will ever control climate. We live with it, for better or worse. We can attempt to mitigate its effects, but how successful we'll be at that is a question that is unanswerable at the moment. But the most important thing to me about climate is to realize, as we said earlier, that we, as human beings, let's say we live, for the sake of argument, for 75, 80 years. During our lifetimes, we're going to experience extremes of climate, gorgeous summers, exceptionally cold winters, Category 5 hurricanes, whatever you want. And these are imprinted in our memories, and we say immediately, it's unusual. A good example of this is California. We are in a period of dry years. This year, the rain has been about average. And I saw a headline in a local newspaper, the drought is over. Nonsense. Because if you're really looking at climate, doesn't matter, an exceptionally cold spring here, a very cold winter in the north, a very warm winter in the west, which we had, what you're ultimately looking at is weather. And really, the minimal context in which you can look at climate change ultimately is a century or more, longer probably.
Well, I applaud the effort of this conference, and I note that there's some web streaming going on, so I think people who are, I don't know how much server capacity they have, but people who are interested might be able to watch your talk over the web tonight, and I think they'll probably archive a fair amount of it as well, so planetu.illinois.edu, to say it again. Mm-hmm. I had a few other things, but I should let someone else have a turn. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Quickly here, because we are getting into about our last 5 or 6 minutes, just one question I'd like to have you respond to. Your interest in climate change has to do with that, what that means for human society, civilization, how individuals either adapt or don't. To return to something that I touched on back earlier in the conversation, do you think that there are, in fact, some things that we can learn, some lessons to be taken away from looking at the ancient world, the pre-industrial world, and how those people dealt with climate change in their time? Is there something that we can take away that will help us in dealing with climate change in our time?
That is the question of questions. The biggest thing I take away from it, and this is going to be a rather unsatisfactory answer, is, and this you find if you look at ancient disasters, for example, mm-hmm. how do humans behave in the face of a serious challenge, Hurricane Katrina, a flood, or whatever? Human behavior in the face of climate change fundamentally has changed very little. Because we're human beings, we're Homo sapiens. And we are infinitely innovative, opportunistic, ingenious, and clever. The big difference between us and people before isn't that we have technology. It is that probably our attention span is shorter. I'm being a little controversial here. Mm-hmm. If you're in, say, a subsistence agricultural society in tropical Africa, you live your life on a cycle of seasons, and you assume that your descendants will live the same way, like your ancestors did. We live from election to election, from event to event, from crisis to crisis. What doing anything about climate change in and adjusting to it really requires is a perspective of thinking about of the world of our great-grandchildren. And that is not only appallingly difficult for us to do as human beings, it is almost impossible for anyone to summon the political will to deal with things like building docks in Rotterdam a meter higher because of sea level rise, which the Dutch are doing. Mm. That is the difference between us and them, largely because there are so many more of us around.
We will take at least one more caller. Here's a caller in Morris, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'll try to make this quick. I grew up in the Southwest out in the deserts of California, and they've always had a water problem, and they keep stealing water from the far north, which is the northern part of California, and now they're looking at building some kind of another viaduct that goes all the way up into Oregon and probably parts of Washington, too. Having lived out here for a while, I noticed that we get an abundance of water. You know, we're pretty, but it doesn't take, I want to say, it doesn't take but 2 or 3 weeks to dry the place out. People have to learn to conserve water. I've always said this, and I've been saying this for years, preaching the fact that we're going to be it's going to cost us more for water than it will for gas. And it's not that far away because we are impractical on what we do. It's the way the houses are being built. It's the way the subdivisions are being built. They keep overbuilding and expect the water systems to withstand the influx of people. I need to know, is there a society out there that we can figure out a way to do things without stretching and taxing the water systems? Because I'm a builder, and I got to tell you, I try to make it my own house. I've got water barrels, I got rain barrels out there. I try to use as much of the water that I get from natural stuff versus me turning the spigot on. And then the same thing goes with washing clothes. Is there like a book out there or a group of people that sole purpose is to throw ideas out there to try and be conservative? Because I'd like to know that, or a website. It'd be great to help everybody. Thanks. I'll get off.
Good for you. I really appreciate that. I'm afraid I'm in the very early stages of looking at the whole water thing. I don't know much about it. To my knowledge, the Israelis are some of the people who've done some of the most innovative work in water, because for obvious reasons, in the Negev and places like that, you might want to look there. I do not know about, there were a lot of books on water, but I don't know, there must be organizations out there that do this. I am terribly sorry, I'm the wrong person to ask. If ever I come back in a couple of years, call again, and hopefully I'll know something. Right. But good for you doing it, I appreciate it.
We have a couple minutes left here. I'm thinking of your remarks of just a moment ago, where you're talking about the difficulty for us of taking the long view and really thinking about what we do now and how that will affect many generations to come, which is something we really should be doing, but it's very difficult. And I also thought about some of your earlier comments about just how politics have clouded the whole discussion about climate change and our response. I guess I'm looking for an answer. Well, maybe the answer just isn't there. What do we do about that? Is there some way that we can have a less politically contaminated conversation about where we are and how to respond and try and at least cultivate a little bit more of a future orientation, not so much just right now, but thinking about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow?
I'm involved with a foundation in Seattle which is concerned exclusively with the thousand-year future. And they regard the problem of problems to be focusing people's minds on anything but just tomorrow. Mm-hmm. This is the most fundamental question. It isn't in our nature because we live within our lifetimes. I think the thing that's going to force it is going to be like the previous caller just said, is a really chronic drought. I mean, 1,000 years ago, there were droughts of 150 to 200 years. And the word is prolonged droughts. We've had droughtish conditions in California for the last 5 years. I'm talking 200 years. And 200 years at one point where the snowpack was 45% of what it normally is. So you're talking real drought. Those are the sort of things that do force people reluctantly to think in the long term.
Yeah. And one of the things I think that you have tried to point out in the Great Warming or in talking about this is that, again, to underscore this idea that drought, this is the kind of the hidden thing, the thing that we should be most concerned about, that we really need to be thinking about it because it's something that can sneak up on you. It doesn't just happen overnight. And that, in fact, the places on the planet that are likely to be the most seriously affected are the places that are already dry, the arid and semi-arid regions where things could get even worse, and then you have greater possibility for conflict, for mass migrations of people as they try to go where there's food and water and they can sustain life. And perhaps that's also one of the places where we might see conflict around the issue of water, but places like that would be the places where we would be most likely to see it.
Yes, and the fact is we tend to have a very domestic view of the world. In Europe, they're much more conscious of the developing world, and we're going to inevitably become much more involved with the developing world because of this. But just to finish off, if you really want to be scared, go to Phoenix and just look at the way the desert is being paved. It is being paved purely on looted water from aquifers, canals from the Colorado. They were even buying water from Nevada.
That can't be good. And that's got to be something that's got to get worse. I think, for example, here in this part of the country, where the United States and Canada, particularly those states that surround the Great Lakes, have been very concerned about maintaining access to and control of that resource. And there is this great fear that someone's going to come along and put a pipe in. And there also was a lot of concern about the fact that the legislation intended to sort of prevent that from happening didn't prevent someone from pulling a tanker into Lake Michigan, filling up with water, and then sailing off to someplace else with that water. Mm-hmm. It just seems that we're headed in the direction of inevitable conflict around this particular resource.
Oh, and this is probably the greatest conflict of the next two centuries is water. No question.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop for the moment. If you're interested in reading some more on the subject of global warming and what that's meant for people in the past, the book you want to look at is The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's been out for about a year now, just come out in paperback, published by Bloomsbury Press. And the author, our guest, Brian Fagan. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's here in our area to take part in the conference Planet U, The Human Story of Climate Change, a major three-day conference. People here on this campus involved and from all over taking part. He'll be giving the keynote speech for the conference that's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. And again, you want to find out more about the conference, go to their website, which is www.planetu.illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Dick.
Support comes for the program today comes from 40 North, 88 West, presenting the 7th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 16th through the 19th, a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater.